Coming up on Fronteras, new EPA rules to cut carbon emissions are expected to be unveiled soon. Coal generates nearly half of this country's electricity and is the largest source of air pollution. The new rules are expected to spur the use of a so-called clean coal technology.
By putting it into a gaseous form, you're much more easily able to pull out all the bad stuff, including carbon dioxide.
Details on a planned clean coal project in West Texas. And there are fewer than 100 fluent speakers of Kumeyaay left in Southern California and Northern Baja California, where they once dominated. Efforts are now underway to preserve the endangered language. That story and more, but first the news. This is Fronteras, a journalism project that covers the U.S.-Mexico border region, immigration, and the rising Latino demographic. Fronteras was created through an unprecedented multimedia collaboration among several public radio stations. I'm Crystal Chavez. A new study shows immigration at a young age for Hispanics may increase the risk for alcohol and drug problems later. The study will be published in July in the online issue of Alcoholism, Clinical and Experimental Research. It jumps off previous research that shows immigrants tend to have lower rates of alcohol and drug problems than people born in the U.S. Jennifer Ringel says that may be because of cultural and Hispanic family values that can help discourage risky behavior. Ringel is assistant professor at the University of Texas Health School of Public Health. She said researchers wanted to see how age of immigration played into the risks for alcohol use and abuse in adulthood. So they talked to Mexican-American adults who live near the U.S.-Mexico border and Mexican-Americans who live in large cities not close to the border, including L.A. and Miami.
What we found is that those who came before the age of 12 were much more likely to use drugs. They acted much more like U.S.-born adolescents when they were adults than people who were immigrants.
Immigrants who came after early adolescence showed a lower risk of alcohol and drug problems later in life. Ringel says the loss of cultural values may play a big role.
So what we're thinking is that the earlier that you come, the more you start to act like somebody who's U.S.-born, right, because your personal identity isn't solidified at all.
There are more studies in the works about immigrants and their health, including a study on immigrants and smoking habits. The Democrat facing newly nominated Republican Dan Patrick in the Texas Lieutenant Governor's race says Senator Patrick's pledge to campaign in the minority community is insulting. KERA's Shelley Koffler takes a look at the race shaping up between the two state senators, Democrat Leticia Vandepute of San Antonio and Republican Dan Patrick from Houston.
After trouncing three-term Lieutenant Governor David Dewhurst to win the Republican nomination, 64-year-old Dan Patrick thanked his Tea Party supporters and the Almighty.
But we always knew in the end the victory was his. And tonight, I give all the glory to God for this victory.
Then Patrick turned his attention to the race in November against 59-year-old Leticia Vandepute. She's a Latina who sits right behind him in the Texas Senate.
Some Democrats have said they wanted me to be the nominee. Well, they've got me and I'm coming.
Patrick told supporters he plans to campaign in minority communities that traditionally vote for the other party, Democrats.
We are going to go into Hispanic communities and African-American communities all across the state during this race. Because number one, before you can get someone's vote, you have to respect them enough to go talk with them and explain who you are.
I wonder where he's been.
Vandepute claims Patrick has been campaigning for over a year, but until now has spent little time meeting with minority voters.
To hear that he's now going to go into Latino communities, well, good luck. Because you've just spent the last 6 months insulting most of them.
Vandepute describes Patrick's approach to border security as toxic. He often links drug crimes and human trafficking to illegal immigration, and he's called for deploying more law enforcement to secure the border. But what really gets Vandepute going is Patrick's promise to repeal in-state tuition for children of illegal immigrants who grew up here. She sponsored that legislation, known as the Texas Dream Act.
These children have graduated from Texas schools. It's smart to have them pay the same amount as the folks that they graduated with. It's been working since 2001.
Patrick has said Texas's limited means should be used to support students who are here legally.
God, welcome to the grassroots of the Republican Party.
So as his victory celebration winds down, the next battleground is taking shape.
I'm ready and excited.
Shelley Koffler, KERA News.
The recent death of Maya Angelou has saddened people around the world. Reporter Jack Morgan spoke about the loss with a familiar San Antonio voice.
And who better for that perspective than former San Antonio Poet Laureate Carmen Tafoya?
With the passing of Maya Angelou, we have lost not just a great literary voice, but a courageous voice in defense of humanity.
I know what the caged bird feels when the sun is bright on the upland slopes, when the wind blows soft through the springing grass and the river floats like a sheet of glass.
She truly helped our nation understand why the caged bird sang, and also to understand a small part of what it would take to set that bird free. She broadened our sense of humanity.
Angelou's life story was that of a performer, poet, writer, speaker, and much more.
Whenever I look at her life, I feel filled with joy that it was a life lived to the maximum potential.
Did you ever meet her?
Yes, I met her several times at different literary conferences in the 80s and 90s. She carried with her an aura of compassion, but absolutely undauntable strength.
When the first bird sings, and the first bud opes, and the faint perfume from its chalice steals, I know what the caged bird feels.
For more on Maya Angelou, go to TPR.org. Jack Morgan, Texas Public Radio News.
Truly an amazing woman. There's more Fronteras coming up. Native speakers and linguists are fighting to preserve an endangered language. Fronteras has more after the break. This is Fronteras. I'm Crystal Chavez. New EPA rules aimed at cutting carbon emissions are expected to be unveiled Monday. It's a big deal. Coal generates nearly half of this country's electricity and is the largest source of air pollution. The new rules are expected to spur the use of a clean coal technology. At least that's the hope of both the coal industry and some environmental groups. Lauren Madelon of Marfa Public Radio has this report on a planned clean coal project in West Texas, one of only two in the country.
The wind is blowing across a 600-acre piece of land in Panwell, currently a ghost town in the Permian Basin of West Texas. Abandoned oil tanks are strewn across the empty field. The directors of a plan known as the Texas Clean Energy Project say a coal-fired power plant will be built right here over the next 4 years. It's a plant some people say will be an environmental game changer.
I am in favor of building electric power plants that capture their carbon.
That's Laura Miller, former mayor of Dallas. As mayor, she was not in favor of the construction of 11 coal-fired electric power plants in Texas. That was in 2007. Fast forward to 2014. Miller now heads up this $3.5 billion Texas Clean Energy Project, which, despite the name, is all about making electricity from coal, but not the old way.
Traditional coal plants take a lump of coal, put a match to it, and it burns up a smokestack, and you try desperately to pull off sulfur, mercury, grit off the coal emissions.
The new twist? Turning coal into gas.
21st century coal takes coal and puts it in a large receptacle called a gasifier, and you add a little pure oxygen and you heat it up to 3,000 degrees Fahrenheit, and you make a gas out of the lump of coal.
Miller says that's what marks this technology.
by putting it into a gaseous form, you're much more easily able to pull out all the bad stuff, including carbon dioxide.
It's a technology called carbon capture and storage, CCS. 8 U.S. plants use this technology right now and bury the carbon dioxide, or CO2, in the ground theoretically permanently. What's new here is the plan to recycle the CO2. A major Texas utility has agreed to buy captured CO2 to make electricity, and CO2 will also be used to extract oil here in the Permian Basin, the country's largest producing oil field. The operation also makes byproducts like fertilizer and even baking soda. As hopeful as that might sound, critics charge that any use of CCS will slow the country's migration to renewables like wind and solar. But several major environmental groups, historical foes of coal, support the project. Here's why.
If we can find a way, like they're trying to in Texas, to use our coal without contributing to climate change, it would be in the strategic interest of the United States.
Tim Profeta is the director of the Nicholas Institute for Environmental Solutions at Duke University.
Any new technology brings along risks of will it perform and how much exactly will it cost.
Meaning it's a calculated but expensive roll of the dice.
And you never can really answer those questions without actually deploying those new technologies. By putting this capture technology on the ground, we are narrowing the risks around its further deployment. And it's very important to do the first one.
The EPA won't force existing plants to adopt CCS. But by mandating emission reductions, the agency hopes the technology is adopted as new plants are built, making CCS cost-effective over time. The Environmental Defense Fund's Jim Marston says CCS is also critical for emerging energy-hungry economies.
The real opportunity for growth is actually in China and India, where they're continuing to build new coal plants, and we could clean up their plants, and we need to do that very quickly because China is now surpassing the U.S. as the number one emitter of carbon dioxide.
In fact, China's already in this game. China's Export-Import Bank has agreed to lend the Texas project $2.5 billion, making its largest foreign investment in the technology. Changing the U.S. power infrastructure is like stopping a guided missile cruiser. It can't be done quickly, which is why supporters of the Texas project say the technology is important right now. I'm Lorne Madelon in Penwell, Texas.
For the last 5 years in Texas, there's been a peaked interest in olive oil farming, but several farmers say it's not enough to call it the next oil boom. Texas Public Radio's Ryan Poppy reports on some of the uncontrollable challenges holding this growing industry back.
Starting in the 17th century, Spanish missionaries attempted to make olive orchards a part of Texas's landscape, but for one reason or another, the industry never took off until more recently. This is Jim Henry, a pioneer in farming olives in Texas. He's the co-owner of the Texas Olive Ranch near Carrizo Springs. He was also given a grant by the state's Agriculture Commissioner to start the Texas Olive Oil Council in 1994, a group tasked with promoting Texas olive oil and helping guide those new to the business. He says he's had to face some hard lessons along the way. He now uses that knowledge to either educate or convince people not to go into business.
I tell people you have to figure out what you want to be in 5 years. You want to have 100 acres, you want to have 50 acres. You got to figure out what you're going to be, and then you got to figure out how you're going to get there.
But the plains of the Gulf Coast is not the only area growing olives successfully. In Wimberley, Jack Doherty owns Bella Vista Ranch. Doherty is skeptical that olive oil will ever become a singular, sustainable agricultural product in Texas.
I don't think there is or are many places in Texas, if any, that we can put thousands of trees in the ground and get consistent output that would support the kind of infrastructure that an industry is necessary to have in order to be successful.
Doherty takes his argument to the next level, identifying temperature spikes that he's witnessed killing hundreds of trees. Temperature spikes that he says aren't regular occurrences in places like California, Spain, or Italy, where olives are grown successfully. He also explains how olive trees are alternate bearing, meaning 1 year a farmer might get a large crop, and the next 2 years very little.
We're in Texas, and we have a whole series of problems, mostly weather-related, that affect our trees when they're young. And that delays the actual time of production. And it delays the production of a good quality crop on a consistent basis. It certainly affected us.
He then drives the point home, taking me outside to show me some of the damaged trees from this winter.
But, you know, I know right now There are some olives on the tree. Come on over here and take a look. Right at the beginning of the development cycle, so they're very, very tiny. This year is going to be a very light crop because we had a very, very, very bad winter. There are olives on the trees out there. We just went through a bloom cycle.
Doherty is proud to show these grayish-green nubs at the end of the tree's blooms. They're tiny, about the size of a pin.
See some right here?
Yeah.
Here's a lot of them over here. And these are getting to be pretty good size now. Look at the size of those. You can tell they're olives now. See that?
The trees are generally harvested in the fall. Doherty says he has an estimated 1,200 olive trees and an equivalent-sized vineyard. But neither of these, he says, compares to the money he makes from people wanting to visit and see firsthand a working farm that looks like the Tuscan countryside, only in Texas. He says many of the bigger olive orchards use agrotourism to supplement their income. Still, for pioneers like Jim Henry and the Texas Olive Oil Council, the state is close to another kind of oil boom.
Well, what we really need in Texas are large commercial orchards with commercial farmers. And we're finding that that is starting to happen. And along the Gulf Coast, we're getting several 100-acre orchards that are going in. And, you know, then that makes it a meaningful industry. And we hope to expand on that with processing facilities, professional marketing. So it looks like we're finally starting to get there after all these years.
In the mid-1990s, there was only a handful of trees, which included those planted over 300 years ago. Henry says in 2010, that jumped to over 800,000 trees. Today, there's just over 1 million olive trees in Texas, which in 2013 produced an estimated 30 to 40,000 gallons of oil. Ryan Poppy, Texas Public Radio News.
Kumeyaay was once the main language spoken in San Diego County in Baja California, but up to 90% of the Kumeyaay population died soon after Europeans colonized the area. Now there are fewer than 100 fluent speakers left, and all but a handful of them live south of the border. Frontera's reporter Jill Replicle met some of them and brought back this story of efforts to preserve the endangered language.
It's a wildly windy day outside the home of Norma Mesa Calles in the Kumeyaay community Juntas de Neji, about an hour south of Tecate. Norma watches as her six-year-old grandson, Matt, cracks open acorns. She gives him pointers in her native tongue. Matt is Norma's hope for keeping the Kumeyaay language and culture alive. Speaking in Spanish in her tiny kitchen, Norma says she's putting all of her efforts into teaching this grandson to speak fluent Kumeyaay. I want to make up for not teaching my own kids to speak Kumeyaay, she says. Norma's home language school is one small contribution to a weighty task, keeping the language from going the way of thousands of other minority languages, that is, extinct.
Out of 6,000 approximate languages that are spoken in the world, only about 100 of them are really safe right now. And those are big languages like Spanish and English and, you know, Russian and Chinese.
Margaret Field is a linguist at San Diego State University. She says the Kumeyaay language has fared better south of the border than north because of differences in education policy.
There's a long history of American Indian people being forced to go to boarding school where they were actively, their languages were repressed, their languages and cultures were repressed, and they were taught to be ashamed of their language. That didn't happen in Mexico. Instead, what happened is people either didn't go to school or they went to school for just a little while.
That's the case with Norma Mesa Calles and her three sisters. They only went to school for a few years as children. Norma says she didn't learn Spanish until she was 13. Now, as adults, the sisters have a rare expertise in their endangered language and culture.
Hola. Hola.
Margaret Field greets Norma and two of her sisters at the Kumeyaay Museum in Tecate. They've been meeting regularly for the past 5 years to record and document the language. One of the main outcomes will be a dictionary of all five dialects of Kumeyaay spoken in Baja California. It's a painstakingly slow process. Today, they're going over just a few sentences of a Kumeyaay creation story that the sisters recorded.
Mm-hmm.
I can highlight a phrase at a time or even a word at a time and play it over and over again. And we try to very exactly write down in Kumeyaay each word in each sentence in the story. And then after we get done with that, we go through and translate it.
Back in the Kumeyaay communities of Baja, the real work of keeping the language alive takes place. Norma has a hard time getting her grandson Matt to say a few words in Kumeyaay to the visiting journalists, but he is willing to sing a traditional song. We really started at zero, Norma says, because our grandkids didn't even know they were Kumeyaay. At school, people called them Indians, and they think, oh, I must be from Oaxaca. Now they know, and they're proud to be Kumeyaay. If Norma succeeds in making her grandson a fluent speaker of his ancestral language, it'll then be his turn to keep the language alive and eventually to pass it on to his own children. That, at least, is his grandmother's hope. In San Diego, I'm Jill Replogle.
You've been listening to Fronteras. It's a journalism project that covers the U.S.-Mexico border region, immigration, and the growing Latino demographic. Fronteras is a collaboration of public radio stations all along the Southwest. You can find the entire audio for this program and past Fronteras shows at tpr.org under the Programs tab. If you want to share these stories with your friends on social media, there are one-click buttons to Facebook and Twitter. This theme music was composed by Charanga Cakewalk. I'm Texas Public Radio's Crystal Chavez. Thank you for listening.